Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Three quarters of the world's energy consumption takes place in cities. If you can't green up the world's cities, you can't green up the planet. A green city movement sees urban centers as the most promising terrain for green innovation. This hour on Point, green cities and their promise for the environment. You can join the conversation. How green is your city, your town? And could, should, must cities lead the way when it comes to going green? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Joan Fitzgerald. Her new book is Emerald Cities. She's director of the Law, Policy, and Society Program at Northeastern University. Joan Fitzgerald, welcome. Great to have you here.
Hello, Tom. Glad to be here.
And with us from Toronto is Jeb Brugman, urban development consultant and author of Welcome to the Urban Revolution, How Cities Are Changing the World. He's founder of ICLEI, Local Governments for Sustainability, a coalition of more than 1,000 local governments that have taken a sustainable development pledge. Jeb Brugman, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Joan.
So, Joan, 75% of the world's energy consumption in cities, that means they've got a big responsibility, yet we don't think of them as oases of green. We think of them as, you know, lots of roads and big towers with lots of energy being pumped through them. Are cities really green, or is this a hope, a vision?
Well, cities are actually the greenest place on Earth. When you think about energy consumption, it's density that eliminates a lot of energy use.
So why? You mean density of people, of population?
Density of people, but density of housing. So just by virtue of having attached housing, apartments, you get a level of density that just doesn't exist in detached housing. So if you do nothing else to make that housing...
But live closer together.
Right. You'll save a lot of energy. Mm-hmm. Similarly, the larger the city, the more likely you are to have public transportation. And so the easier it is to get about. People who live in cities walk more. They use buses, subways more. So the biggest factors to greenhouse gas are transportation and housing. So cities are also the biggest source of greenhouse gas, but also their density will make them the solution.
There must be a huge range here. Jeb Brugman, when you look at cities around the world, I mean, the distance from the worst and most polluting, least efficient, least green, to the best and most green, how big is the range, Jeb?
It's a very broad range. In fact, when we started ICLEI in the early 1990s, we did a system-wide energy analysis of 14 metro areas, American cities, Canadian cities, European cities, and Ankara, Turkey. And we found the range went from the energy efficiency of Greater Miami-Dade County, 30%, to Helsinki, Finland, 73% efficiency of energy use going into the total urban system for transportation, for buildings, for infrastructure, for electricity. So the range is broad, and it's based on that range that you can begin to learn how we need to transform our American cities to become more like the Helsinkis.
Joan, what are the kinds of things that cities can do that differentiate, that decide whether you've got 30% efficiency or 70% efficiency? What are some of the things that make that difference?
Well, one of them is transportation and the extent to which people use public transportation, or even in many northern European cities, bicycles are a common means of transportation. The second one is efficiency of buildings. And again, the idea of attached buildings, but also right now we see many cities using the ARRA funds to subsidize energy efficiency measures.
So ARRA?
I'm sorry, just the stimulus funds.
Uh-huh.
And so I think we're moving. We have a real opportunity now for many cities to move in that direction.
That direction being?
Greater efficiency.
Meaning more insulation in cold places and hot places.
More better windows, more efficient heating and cooling systems. Right.
Jeb, give us some examples of other distinguishing factors you see. Maybe it's those in the 70% efficiency versus the 30.
Yeah, I agree fully with Joan that density, and I hope we get into this idea of density because people think about it as just being lots of people. It's a much richer idea mm-hmm. than that. Mm-hmm. And the buildings are definitely the low-hanging fruit within our cities, and Joan is correct to make it even more clear to the listeners. The reason that attached residences are so efficient is that the amount of surface area for the amount of living space is much less, right? So there's much less exposure to mm-hmm. the hot summer and the cold winter. So it's purely a physical process thing, and you can't argue against the density of buildings in terms of fuel efficiency. I mean,
sort of the beehive of the apartment building versus the suburban sprawl of individual houses, each with their own systems and many walls and windows.
It has an inherent physical efficiency to it. But our buildings in American cities, on average, are around 80% efficient. So that low-hanging fruit won't feed us for long. We can increase the efficiency another 5%, get it up even if you get to LEED standard, platinum and such, get it to 90% efficiency. Mm-hmm. But the real savings we found were available in American cities had to do with something different. It had to do with centralized power production, where you get 67% transmission and distribution losses when you have centralized production and then you distribute it at a distance to cities around a state or a region.
In other words, so, if you've got a power plant off in the distance that's shipping it into the city, you've got a lot of loss along the way, you're saying?
Enormous losses. 67% of the electricity is lost. And think about how we compete. As a nation, if 67% of the electricity generated is actually lost on the way to the household.
I don't even understand that. Where does that electricity go if it's lost from the, I don't know, the power cables?
We'll have to get an engineer to explain us, but it's through the transmission lines mm-hmm. itself. I guess it's lost into the atmosphere. But
so are you suggesting somehow make it right in the city? Make that.
This is where you find if you go to Finland or you go to Germany and you find out why are they reaching 70% is because they still have municipal utilities. And in the United States, where you have local power production, municipal utilities, where you're doing district heating plants, combined power and heating plants, where you localize the power production process, you can get enormous efficiency. So now there are municipalities in Sweden going to be carbon neutral. In other words, you know, no net carbon emissions. That's one area.
Wow.
The other thing is dependency on the automobile. People don't realize our automobile engines only use 20% of the fuel energy that goes into them. So the more you're dependent on the automobile, the more inefficient your whole urban system is. And that's where if you can get to multimodal transportation with pedestrianism, bicycles, public transit, other kinds of engine technology, you can also rapidly increase your efficiencies. Buildings are key, but they're only the first and also the most economical first step. But there are other major investments we need to make to become these green cities.
Carbon neutral sounds like a pretty mind-bending idea for a city. Joan, you spent a lot of time in Europe looking at cities there. Freiburg, Germany, you open your book with, where they've done a lot of work on solar and with that creation of renewable energy right there within, alongside the community. How successful have they been with that? I mean, how much of their, you know, as an example, how much of their energy can they come up with from alternative sources right there in the community?
Freiburg is the city that motivated me to write this book. Mm-hmm. And what I saw there was an attempt to build a nuclear power plant. The city and people within it protested that and decided that they were going to become a solar city mm-hmm. and developed a plan to do so. And part of what they did was developed what's called a feed-in tariff. And that just means that they were going to buy all of the renewable energy that was produced. So they subsidized putting solar panels on just about every public building in the city, and solar companies started building their products there. Mm-hmm. So they created an entire industry. So they linked this sustainability to economic development.
So if I've got solar panels on my roof and they're creating more than I use, I'm feeding it into the system.
You,
somebody else can use it.
Right.
I get paid for it.
You get paid for it. And in fact, it was the cities in Germany that came up with this policy that the German government then implemented. And as a result of that, Germany for many years has been one of the top exporters of solar and wind technology.
So there's two pieces there. I mean, one is the energy you can produce locally and the efficiency of that. The other is the economic growth that comes along with that. We've heard in this country, though, about, you know, cities, towns setting out to be like solar centers and the production ending up in China.
Right. Unfortunately, that illustrates the limits of what cities can do. And what made Germany successful is that the national government implemented a policy that was happening in cities. What we have now are cities throughout the country trying to become solar cities, ranging from Los Angeles to Toledo, Ohio. But cities can't do it alone. States can't do it alone. We have a hodgepodge of state policies to enforce it. And we don't yet have an energy bill that provides the portfolio standard that says by a certain year we're going to produce a certain percentage of our energy from renewable sources. And we need that. And that will stimulate a solar industry.
A kind of national, policy envelope that encourages cities within it. And yet cities, Jeb, all around the world are working to sort of find their way, whether or not, with different degrees of success, whether or not they've got strong central leadership, as you describe it.
And that's because it's economically rational to do so. And when we hear these reports about how fighting climate change and reducing our carbon footprint is going to wreck our economy, what we're really hearing is a very top-down economic point of view with a bunch of top-down models that make a bunch of set assumptions. I'm an economist. I have worked with those models. I've actually been involved in building those models. What they don't pick up is the kinds of innovations, economic innovations that can happen at the local level within businesses themselves that can actually make transforming to green spaces a very economically rational thing to do, saving money, making your economy more efficient.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about green cities and their role in an environmental revolution. Joan Fitzgerald is here. She's author of Emerald Cities, Urban Sustainability and Economic Development. Jeb Brugman joins us from Toronto, author of Welcome to the Urban Revolution, How Cities Are Changing the World. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And Joan, Jeb, we have a lot of callers here. Let's go to Ted in Montreal. Ted, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for this great topic. I spent a lot of time in Vienna, and a bit like Freiburg, I think it's a very innovative green city in the sense that you notice a distinctive tower in the center of Vienna which releases steam. And what it does is this tower, all the trash and rubbish is collected and brought into this tower, and it's incinerated at very high heat. And instead of emitting toxic gases, steam comes out. And much of the steam is used for energy to heat the water supply within the city. So I think it's a brilliant example of what a city can do to lessen CO2 emissions as well as keep the air pollution down.
Ted, that's great. A report from Vienna. I mean, Joan, there's a lot that's being done with waste and efficiency. Ted's got one example there from Vienna. I was hearing recently about cities in Sweden where I think they have vacuum tubes, if that's possible, at the corners where you sort your trash and put it down and it gets composted into energy sources and all the rest. Give us a sense of what kind of things are going on the waste side to capture, because those dense populations do produce a lot. It depends how you treat it as to, you know, the efficiency you get from it.
Right. Our caller is right. It's not just Vienna. It's cities throughout Europe who use incineration and then produce energy from that rather than landfilling. There's a lot of resistance to incineration in the United States, and I think part of the reason is it used to be a dirty technology, but the incinerators now don't release the same gases at all. They're very clean. They do not inhibit recycling and are very efficient.
So what are you burning there if you're not? Presumably Vienna's also recycling, so it's just...
Right, everything else. But
if you're recycling paper and you're... I mean, a lot of cities we hear in Europe now are composting the compostable materials. You're burning plastic and everything else, as you say. It sounds
you're burning
a little scary,
everything
but maybe
else,
it can be clean.
And the filtration systems are very, very, very effective.
Mm-hmm.
But to go to the example in Stockholm, this is a whole neighborhood of the city called Hammarby Sjöstad that was a brownfield site, a former manufacturing area that was redeveloped.
Mm-hmm.
And how the trash goes, people put it in three different tubes. And it's, if you think like when you go to a drive-in bank and how the tube sucks it away.
Right.
It's the same thing, except it goes underground. And there's
That's
one
amazing.
Tube for recycling, one tube for organic waste, mm-hmm. and one tube for everything else. It goes to a central processing plant. That can be which recycled is, that which can be incinerated for energy is, mm-hmm. And then they also make compost with the organics. And that compost is used throughout the city. Malmo, Sweden is also experimenting with that. The technology...
The compost is used as in to garden around the city?
Right. It's used in all the parks or people
so
can
the
use
leftover
it. Absolutely.
Peas and spaghetti end up as soil in somebody's, I don't know, backyard or
they
along
do.
The highways.
They do indeed.
Wow. Wow, and pneumatic tubes, that's pretty incredible. Jeb, what have you seen on the waste front? Cities produce a lot of it, the different ways it gets used.
Well, I think Joan touches on the history of opposition to waste incineration in the United States. A big part of the argument was that if you create this power plant that needs this big feedstock of garbage to fuel it at a level of operating efficiency, then there's not a basis for having recycling programs. So people saw that there's a trade-off between waste diversion and recycling and burning. Actually, what we find, for instance, here in Toronto, where we have a very ambitious diversion rate of more than 50% of our solid waste into recycling, is that the markets don't support recycling wastes at various times. So you may end up warehousing vast amounts of plastics because there's not really a market for it, and it becomes uneconomical. So this new technology and combined waste generation that's being used in Scandinavia and now around mm-hmm. Europe is actually provides a way to economically use certain waste streams if the market doesn't support the recycling of it. So it's part of creating a diversified strategy to make sure that you get the energy value and the material value out of waste rather than having to encourage the production of new virgin materials for our packaging. And
what about energy from organic waste? I was talking with a company recently, and their whole business is, doesn't just make compost. It actually, ferments, or I think they called it a digester of some kind they feed it into, that you get energy out the other end. Jeb?
Well, a big part of what local governments found through our work with ICLEI. ICLEI has a program called Cities for Climate Protection, where now for 20 years we've been working with the solid waste departments and the engineering departments and the planning departments to test many of these measures and analyze them. What you find is that you can get incredible efficiencies by recapturing just the methane from your landfills and use that as a feedstock. So now when you do composting, you could recover the methane from the composting, or you can compost another way where you don't produce the methane. So there's a whole variety of technologies that have been developed from the bottom up from cities, which is why the notion of Emerald Cities is so compelling, that the cities are actually the incubators of all these new technologies that actually are viable on a market basis. Unlike centralized power production, which requires typically a central government subsidy, like our nuclear power plants, all of these new technologies that have been experimented with by local governments over the last 20 years proved to be viable on a market basis.
Joan, have you seen this, what do you call it? Is it anaerobic digestion? Where the sort of scrapings from all the leftover dinner and everything else turns into organic energy production somehow?
Right.
How's it work?
We're just beginning to use it in the U.S. Several Canadian cities have been using it. Think giant blender.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is the waste is put in there. It moves around so that all the plastic bags and so forth come to the top.
Mm-hmm.
And it produces something called digestate. And if you further process
the organic essence of whatever was in the
right. Mm-hmm. So you can further process that to produce fuel, or you can make compost for it. And different cities are experimenting in different ways. And in the United States, it's very new technology. Los Angeles is looking into anaerobic digestion and several California cities.
I want to talk about where the United States is comparatively and why at this point. Let's hear from our listeners. Debbie in Fort Myers, Florida. Debbie, you're on the air.
Hey, I took a group of people. I live in Fort Myers in the winter, and then we spend the summer near Charlotte, and I took a group of people from Charlotte to Gainesville, Florida.
Okay.
Gainesville actually studied the German model. They went to Germany, and we met with their mayor and their utilities strategic planner. They are doing feed-in tariffs. it's a form of the same thing that they're doing in Germany. So the businesses are prospering. The Chamber of Commerce loves it because new businesses are coming in. People are putting solar on their rooftops.
And Debbie, when you say feed-in tariff, that's this idea that if I produce energy with a solar array on my rooftop and it's more than I need, I can feed it into the system and be paid for it by my energy utility.
Well,
is that right?
Or
is that wrong? Joan's saying I'm wrong. Joan, help me here. Stick with this, Debbie.
It's a little better than that, because what they do is actually they use their existing lines and you feed it in directly to the power company.
Okay.
So in Gainesville, they pay you for how much you generate. You still pay your electric bill.
Right.
But they pay you something equal to about three times your electric bill. Banks love it because they're going to loan money because they know they're going to get the money back again. Everybody's thriving. The whole city is thriving. And we brought some folks from Charlotte to check it out and hopefully to try and bring it back to Charlotte area. I'm trying to promote that here in the Fort Myers, Florida area. The reason it's so easy for Gainesville to do this is because they're a municipal electric company.
So it's a local company. Can you see it, Debbie, in Gainesville? Can you actually see the greater profusion of solar panels there?
Oh, yeah. I have a friend who's got University of Florida, Hillel. He's putting solar on his roof. He researched it. He's going to bring in extra money for his nonprofit organization, and he's got it totally financed except for $2,500 from the installer. And it's just so exciting. You can feel the excitement there. That the Chamber of Commerce, there's lots of articles in the paper about it.
That's pretty great. It's pretty great. We hear the cross-pollination there from Germany to Gainesville and maybe to Fort Myers and maybe to Charlotte. Joan, feed-in tariffs?
Yeah, let me clarify that in a comment on Florida. A feed-in tariff is a little more than that. What it is, the government tells utilities you have to buy all of the renewable energy that's produced, and you buy it at a subsidized rate, and the subsidy goes down over a period, usually of 20 years.
This is to motivate people to get renewable energy going on their
home
or business.
And larger scale, utility scale solar and wind, as well as putting it on your house. Mm-hmm. So it also creates a stable investment environment. Right now, solar is not cost competitive, and it allows the companies that are doing the research and the universities to keep doing it, knowing that they're going to sell their product, and it allows them to get more efficient over time.
So who has this in the states? Florida, or is there a national policy? Or is it state by state?
There's a few states that are doing it, and a very few cities, but you need to do something at a larger scale. And Gainesville's doing great work. One of the unfortunate things in Florida is the legislature just defunded their program that's helping people to purchase solar energy. The claim is that they can't afford it any longer. But again, if there's any place, the Sunshine State, you would think they would be able to develop
a solar
industry. And they've just given up on it, essentially.
Wow. Debbie, thanks for your call. Steve in Boston. Steve, you're on the air.
Hey, I just had a question. I used to live in Helsinki, and there's a lot that we can learn from them, obviously. But the first thing that I noticed is that it's in the people's consciousness as to what they do, and it starts, you know, from everyday things like recycling. They really, nobody fines them for not putting cans and bottles in one bag and a litter in the other, but they do it anyways and take it out as such. I mean, it was just, to me, it was kind of mind-boggling, but everybody does it. And I think it would take at least the generations for Americans to begin to do that on a massive scale. Any projections? How does that play into the any calculations?
That is a very interesting question, Steve, and I thank you for your call. Jeb, let me take that first to you, that this range of public attitudes about participating, you know, whether you're in the countryside or the city, if you're not inclined to play a role, that means wind in the face of green efforts. Do you see a big difference in public consciousness in different cities, in different countries when it comes to green efforts?
Well, the caller points out a critical aspect of the greening of our cities that we've been talking about, the technological fixes and the economic aspects of it, but the whole issue of culture and how cities are centers of cultural transformation is critical. So, you know, when people move to cities, they self-select to be in certain cities and then in certain districts and neighborhoods within cities. And what we're finding is that It's these self-selecting groups that then become the incubators of green transformations. For instance, I was a student at the University of Freiburg, Germany, in the 1970s when the students were organizing the Green Party and demonstrating against the nuclear power plant.
And that became a huge political force in Germany.
And that transformed Freiburg into the solar capital of the world, and all of this innovation that's now being diffused to the Gainesvilles and all over the world. And so what we find is, to use a word from the sort of urban studies realm, is it's the urbanism, the culture of living in the cities is critical. So why does Helsinki have 73% efficiency, exactly like as a Kohler said? There's a whole history in Northern Europe and Scandinavia of living in the city in an efficient way and supporting that kind of innovation and transformation, which is why you see the Swedish cities now saying we're going to become carbon neutral in the next 20 years.
Joan, what about this cultural factor? How does it play in?
I think you can motivate people's behavior in different ways. So, for example, one thing you could do around recycling and trash is have people pay by the bag for their trash collection. Recycling is free. You have to pay.
It's free if you're recycling. If it's just unrecyclable trash, you'd pay for that. In other words, impose a penalty. Okay. Yeah.
Right. That's just one example. There's more positive ways to do it. Newcastle in Australia has made a goal of becoming the most energy efficient city. And one of the things they do in their downtown, they have a billboard that has a graph that shows their energy use. They have 12 districts in the city, and they have a contest about which area can reduce its energy consumption the most.
So neighborhoods are kind of competing to be the best at it.
Exactly. And then they have children in the schools doing the same thing. So I think there are ways you build awareness and then motivate people. One thing people are doing is putting on a utility bill how your energy consumption compares to your neighbors, and have found that's a motivator.
That alone.
I
don't doubt it. Let's get a call from Roseburg, Oregon. Ken, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, hi.
This is really hitting home with something that I'm trying to get into the middle of. My wife and I are buying a piece of property out in a very rural area, and we're having a hard time getting a bank to tell us that they'll give us a mortgage after we can do the construction. And I want to go completely green and solar, and I don't know if I can now because I may not be able to get the financing for my construction.
So they're not putting a value on that solar energy. They don't want to loan you extra money to do that, I guess, Ken.
They're leery of it. Yeah, they really are. It's, to me, to get power to that where I want to build now, it's going to be near $40,000, and I'm sure I could get solar for a lot less than that with the tax incentives and the rebates that are supposedly out there and offered right now. But if I can't get the bank to give me an okay on a loan, I'm kind of up a creek.
Yeah, Ken, we hear it. Thanks for your call. I mean, Jeb, here's the cultural piece again, I guess, from the business angle. Whether you're in the countryside, as Ken is, or in the city, you've got to have kind of whole awareness of what it takes to get into the green stream to make it happen.
And you need economies of scale, which is where the pattern of development in the United States of trying to live an urban life in terms of your job and your profession, but live a rural life in terms of where you're located and go home to in the evening, it doesn't provide the economies of scale so that a whole bunch of people who want to have a green neighborhood can leverage the capital investment together to do so. You see this, for instance, in the central business districts of cities throughout the United States. The business community organizes revolving loan funds and ways of securitizing investments so that then the banks will get involved because the risk is reduced. Mm-hmm. It's this district or neighborhood approach to investment that actually makes it a viable investment opportunity rather than us as individuals out in the suburbs or the countryside trying to do it on our own.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about green cities this hour and their big role in cleaning up the environment globally, what it is today, what it might be one day. Joan Fitzgerald is with us. Her new book is Emerald Cities. Jeb Brugman is with us from Toronto. He's founder of ICLEI, the Local Governments for a Sustainability Organization, author of Welcome to the Urban Revolution. We're going to go in just a moment the town of Greensburg, Kansas, flattened by a tornado in 2007, now coming back green. Let's get a couple of calls first. Andy in Boston, you're on the air, Andy.
Hi, Tom. I work with a network of CEOs and innovators that are creating a lot of the technologies and commercializing a lot of the technologies that your guests and callers are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And what we keep hearing from them, and the purpose of our bringing them into a network, is that unless we influence federal policy, there's only so much scale they can go to with all of these different brilliant innovations coming mm-hmm. from science. And so pricing carbon is the way to do that. And I even heard a traditional energy CEO from a gas natural gas side say that until we price oil at the pump, gas at the pump, to include the cost of two aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf,
yeah.
we will never be able to accurately compare the price of these new energy, renewable energy technologies to the price of oil. And in that, if that stays the way it is, these will become quirks in a museum in the future of a time when innovation almost happened, and America's energy economy will just remain stuck, and we will fall further and further behind in terms of competitiveness.
Andy, so that sounds like a very real and important warning here, and I appreciate your calling in with it, and let us pick it up. I mean, Joan, this is kind of the conclusion of your book, that, hey, all this great stuff can happen, but if you don't want it to be quirks in a museum, as Andy says, you want it to be really wide, with widespread adoption, you've got to have, as he puts it, a price on carbon. What about that? I mean, that's we saw House action last year in Washington. Senators Graham and Kerry coming up with something real soon. But do you see enough coming, passing, to let market forces encourage this kind of ultimate green scene, cities and otherwise?
No. And the fact is, it won't become quirks in a museum because other countries get it. If you look at Germany,
then we become the quirk in the museum.
Denmark,
great.
China now, the amount of investment in renewable energy, high-speed rail, the technologies of the future. It's happening, and the question is, are we going to be left behind? And already we are playing a game of catch-up. So the caller is right. We do need to price carbon. We need to stop subsidizing oil and develop the policies that we've been talking about earlier, the feed-in tariff, the portfolio standard, to create demand for it, because cities can't create enough demand. And so we as a nation need to be doing that for renewable energy, high-speed rail, and then these technologies will prosper.
Jeb, we're going to go to the heart of the USA, out to Kansas in just a second here, but where do you see? I mean, if you look around the world at cities and those that are most efficient, you know, what portion are in the U.S.? And do you see national policy from your Canadian perch there making a difference in who's where in the push forward here?
Well, we have a great transformation process to go through in North America. Canada is just as inefficient, really. Toronto is an island of greater efficiency, largely because of its density and lower dependency on the automobile to the typical American cities. But if we're going to compete against other regional economies that, in terms of not just labor productivity and the wage that people are paid that's competitive, but in terms of their energy productivity and their resource productivity, they use their resources efficiently, we're going to have to transform the way we build our cities and transform our low-density suburbs on the fringe into places with density nodes where you can have these kinds of efficiency along corridors and things like that. So, you know, I think that the federal policy is obviously can play a massive role. It played a big role in subsidizing and incenting builders to build suburbs, mm-hmm. and it can be redefined to play a role in incenting people to build green cities. And I think the current administration and some efforts of even past administrations, the first Bush administration, surprisingly, was seed funding all of the work of ICLEI in this realm, is inching in that direction. But we shouldn't wait at the city level, and the cities and the states that respond to their cities are not waiting. They're creating carbon pricing through state policy and through alliances of states. And we need to get on with creating the economics of these kinds of investments through creating density and scale economies, as we've been talking about earlier.
We're going to hear a lot more about carbon pricing, no doubt, in the weeks ahead on Capitol Hill as that heats up. But what's impressive is how many cities and towns around the country are trying to push ahead on their own. Maybe they could have a better environment for it, but there's a lot of innovation going on, and globally, certainly. Let's look at Greensburg, Kansas. You may recall this was the Kansas City, very small city, population today about 1,200, 1,280. Those 80 will matter in a population that size. Practically flattened, tragically, by a tornado in May of 2007. 95% of the little city of Greensburg just taken right to the ground by a tornado that was a couple of miles wide. They committed to coming back green after that devastation, and we're going to check in with them right now to see how that's going. Bob Dixon joins us from Greensburg, Kansas. He's mayor of the city of Greensburg. Mayor Dixon, thank you very much for being there.
Well, hi, Tom, and thanks for having me on the show.
How's it going? Tell us about you coming back up from almost, your ground zero there. How did you do it, and how's it look today? Is it working?
We're seeing tremendous progress made. We're almost three years past the devastating tornado that wiped out 95% of the buildings in town were totally leveled,
yeah,
including schools, churches, hospital, businesses. Everything was gone. We're here in the Midwest. Our ancestors taught us that if you take care of the land, it takes care of you. So it's more than being green. It's about sustainability. It's about being environmental stewards, about being good stewards of the resources we've been blessed with. And so that was instilled in us by our ancestors. So it was our responsibility to build back a community as they built for us oh so many years ago, a community that will last a lifetime and will be sustainable for future generations. So we're making tremendous progress. We've got the highest concentration of lead platinum buildings in the world.
Lead platinum, that's a kind of classification saying just as efficient as they can be.
Not only energy efficiency, but in controlling your waste of building materials, of design, of sustainability, of duration, of how long the building will last. It's a scorecard by the U.S. Green Building Council just to be able to say, are you doing what you say you was going
to
do?
You're about to open the greenest hospital in the country, the first LEED Platinum critical access operation in the country in Kiowa County.
Just had our grand opening on that a few weeks ago, a tremendous facility taking advantage of all the natural resources we have available with wind and solar, geothermal, natural lighting, both with skylights and windows. A very great environment for healing. We were also able to consolidate all healthcare facilities in the community in one building. So that is also sustainable. It has to be financially sustainable, and it made more sense rather than building several buildings to put them all under one roof and have everything consolidated.
So I'm reading about solar and wind you've put in and lots of new buildings since, of course, have to be since everything was knocked right to the ground. But I want to ask you about the economics of this. I mean, because of your very arresting, tragic story of devastation there, you've had a lot of people come in and help you do this. The Department of Agriculture and Frito-Lay, the corporation, came in. I mean, Leonardo DiCaprio, I think, has come in with money for Greensburg. If you didn't have that, would the economics work, Mayor Dixon, if you were just, you know, kind of on your own like most towns and cities in this country?
We would not have made the progress that we've made without that tremendous assistance from individuals in corporate America, not only financially, but in product and in expertise. And we've become a living laboratory, if you would like to use that term, of all the modern technologies, of the concepts of being green that our ancestors taught us about stewardship. So we have ecotourism is a big issue in Greensburg right now, and we have people from all over the world coming just to see all the technology that's being implemented.
When you look 20, 30 years out, you know, after the hoopla of helping you, and it's important hoopla, but after that's passed by, do you see your sustainability as being sustainable? Are the economics there for it long term?
Well, and that was an integral part of our long-term sustainability master plan. Is it's not just meeting our immediate needs,
mm-hmm.
but meeting the ability of future generations and not compromising their ability to meet their needs. So, yes, we want to focus tremendously on the sustainability factor of it, and also in the midst of it, we have to remember it's not just about energy consumption, it's not building great buildings, it's about financial sustainability also. You can do all these things, but you have to make sure that you have people to inhabit the region and the city to take advantage of the great things you're doing.
Lots of challenges, a great vision there. Mayor Dixon in Greensburg, Kansas, population 1,280. We're grateful to you for being with us today, Mr. Mayor. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Listeners, you can see Greensburg's master plan for sustainability at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's go to Richmond, Vermont. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a member of the Select Board here in Richmond and also a clean energy industry professional. And I just want to sing the praises, first of all, of Mayor Peggy Hanrahan from Gainesville, who I had the pleasure to meet at a conference in Germany a couple weeks ago. She had been invited there by the Germans. This is a clean energy export conference, and she'd been invited by the Germans to talk about the feed-in tariff that's going on in Gainesville.
Uh-huh.
I think the point I wanted to make and the question I wanted to ask is we're a town of 4,000 people.
Sure.
We're very small, very rural.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a feed-in tariff in place from Green Mountain Power, and we're looking at property-assessed clean energy, which is an idea that was originated in, I believe, Berkeley, California.
What does it mean, Chris, property-assessed clean energy?
This is a way of making long-term, low-cost financing available for energy efficiency and renewable energy projects on private buildings, but also in public buildings. And what we see is that cities are the incubators of these great ideas, but they're by no means limited to larger cities. And they help small towns like ours become more energy efficient and more sustainable in the long term as well. So there's not a border. I'm a great admirer of the work that Jeb has done in ICLEI.
Mm-hmm.
But we make use of that, and I think it helps us all the way across the economy.
Chris, I appreciate your call. Thanks very much for it. Good luck there in Richmond, where you're a selectman. Joan, how about cities as the incubators of ideas for towns of 4,000? And what about the kind of financing that Chris is talking about there? Is that readily available? Our caller from Oregon wasn't finding it.
Well, it's starting to be available. The Berkeley program is very interesting. It's called Berkeley First. And one of the obstacles for any individual in deciding whether to put on a renewable energy system or even to invest in energy efficiency, for that matter, is the upfront costs. And so the idea of that program is to put it on the property tax bill and keep it with the property tax bill so that if you move in 5 years, you don't take that bill with you. It stays on the property tax.
Are you increasing the taxes I'll pay when I do something efficient, or you're cutting my taxes, or what stays on the property tax bill?
The amount of money to invest in the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is you make this investment,
mm-hmm.
you receive a lot of savings.
Mm-hmm.
Those savings are you appreciate you get the savings. And you pay it back over time that you're not making that upfront investment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, that program's been put on hold for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And San Francisco has one, and the state is trying to pick it up, or the county mm-hmm. is trying to pick it up. So right now we're seeing experiments. They're going on in Milwaukee, Cambridge, and Boston, where cities are trying different ways to subsidize that upfront cost so that people can make the investments.
You like Los Angeles as a green city, an emerald city. That surprises me. We think of it as just urban, you know, car sprawl forever.
I do. And that's why I like it, because Los Angeles has a much bigger problem than, say, a city like Boston or New York has the advantage of very high density
mm-hmm.
public transportation system. They're starting this green game on third base.
Mm-hmm.
Los Angeles has smog traffic. But when I looked at the different chapters in my book, Los Angeles has one of the largest efforts going on now for energy efficiency. They're starting it in their low-income communities. They're linking it to their community colleges for
mm-hmm.
a training program. When it comes to waste, they're trying to improve their 65% recycling rate. And
so even starting in a tough spot, they're really going at it aggressively.
They're building public transportation systems, subways, transit-oriented development. And they're one of the only cities with a solar energy plan to really move to renewables, clean technology park, and economic development. So it's a city that has a long, long way to go, but on every front, they're moving very, very aggressively.
Jeb, we've just got a few seconds here. What portion of the world's cities, because more and more people live in cities, what portion today would you say are going green? Is it 5%, 10%, 40%?
Well, in the United States, just to give you a sense of the sample, there are 620 city counties in the United States who are ICLEI members who are all setting targets for significant reductions in their greenhouse gas emissions. That's a big part of our population, and it's mirrored in cities around the world. So this is a new wave of urban development, and I think bodes well for our future. There's reason for optimism.
Well, the whole world is counting on it, given where the population is going to be. Jeb Brugmann joining us today from Toronto, author of Welcome to the Urban Revolution. Jeb, thanks for being here. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And Joan Fitzgerald, author of Emerald Cities, Urban Sustainability and Economic Development. Joan, wonderful to have you today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And speaking of efficiency and the environment, I recently moderated an interesting panel on businesses going green. You can catch it at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.